I think that's what your sister was getting at when she revealed her relationship struggles in response to your question about the secret to marriage. She wasn't trying to bum you out. She was actually trying to tell you the secret. In allowing you a more intimate view of her much-touted but flawed marriage, your sister was attempting to show you what a real perfect couple looks like, happy, humane, and occasionally all fucked up. I can't imagine anyone more fitting to walk you down the aisle on your wedding day than your sister and her husband, two people who've kept their love and friendship alive for more than 25 years. That you're doubting this after learning not all of those years were easy tells me there's something deeper at work here that has nothing to do with their marriage and everything to do with your own insecurities and fears. You appear to be focused on infidelity as the deal killer that you believe would compel you to automatically dissolve your own future marriage. And that's fair enough. I understand the icky place in your gut where that impulse lives. There's probably nothing more hurtful and threatening than one partner breaking from an agreed-upon monogamous bond. A preemptive ultimatum against that allows at least the sense of control, but it's a false sense. Painful as it is, there's nothing more common in long-term relationships than infidelity in its various versions. Cheated, pretty much cheated. Cheated a teeny bit, but it probably doesn't quite count. Came extremely close to cheating. Want to cheat. Wondering about what it would be like to cheat. Is flirting over email technically even cheating? Etc. The letters in my inbox, the stories of many of my friends, and my own life are a testament to that. I'm not suggesting everyone cheats, of course, and perhaps you and your husband will never have to confront this issue. But if you really want to live happily ever after, if you honestly want to know what the secret to sustaining a lifelong healthy love is, it would be a good idea to openly grapple with some of the most common challenges of doing so, rather than pretending that you have the power to shut them down by making advanced threats about walking out, no conversation required, the moment a transgression occurs. This will require a rethink about your own dark capacities, as well as those of your future husband and the members of various couples you admire. Most people don't cheat because they're cheaters. They cheat because they are people. They are driven by hunger or for the experience of someone being hungry once more for them. They find themselves in friendships that take an unintended turn, or they seek them out because they're horny or drunk or damaged from all the stuff they didn't get when they were kids. There is love. There is lust. There is opportunity. There is alcohol and youth. There is loneliness and boredom and sorrow and weakness and self-destruction and idiocy and arrogance and romance and ego and nostalgia and power and need. There is the compelling temptation of intimacies with someone other than the person with whom one is most intimate, which is a complicated way of saying it's a long damn life happily ever after, and people get mucked up in it from time to time. Even the people we marry. Even us. You don't know what it is you'll get mucked up in yet. But if you're lucky, and if you and your fiancé really are right for each other, and if the two of you build a marriage that lasts a lifetime, you're probably going to get mucked up in a few things along the way. This is scary, but you'll be okay. Sometimes the thing you fear the most in your relationship turns out to be the thing that brings you and your partner to a deeper place of understanding and intimacy. That's what happened to Mr. Sugar and me a couple of years into our relationship when I learned of his infidelity and told him to go fuck himself and then took him back. My decision to stay and work it out with him in the aftermath of that betrayal is way, way far up on the list of the best decisions of my life. And I'm not just grateful that I decided to stay. I'm grateful it happened. It took me years to allow that, but it's true. That Mr. Sugar cheated on me made us a better couple. It opened a conversation about sex and desire and commitment that we're still having. And it gave us resources to draw upon when we faced other challenges later on. The truth is, for all the sweet purity of our early love, we weren't ready for each other in that time during which we loved each other most sweetly. The woman who sent him the postcard pushed us down a path where we made ourselves ready, not to be a perfect couple, but to be a couple who knows how to have a duel when a duel needs to be had. I hope that's what you get too, happily ever after. A bit of Sully in your suite. Not perfection, but real love. Not what you imagine, but what you'd never dream. Yours, Sugar. We are here to build the house. Dear Sugar, I'm a young woman in an American city. I'll be out of a job in a few weeks. Gulp. I'm in the process of entering into an arrangement with a man. We will rendezvous once or twice a week, and he will pay me an allowance of $1,000 a month. About this, I have many conflicting thoughts. There are the practical questions. Is what I'm doing illegal? Is what I'm receiving taxable income? If so, how do I report it? Am I being paid fairly? But also, more importantly, is what I am doing immoral? The man is married. He told me that he loves his wife. He's going to take care of her forever. But she doesn't want sex like she used to. She's not the jealous type. And he'd tell her, but he doesn't want to rub her face in it. To me, this sounds cowardly. I'm a person who believes in non-monogamy. I believe in people making the choices that are the best for them. But I also believe in communication, respect, and integrity. Am I complicit in something awful? And my last set of questions, Sugar, is this something I can do? Is this something I should be doing? I'm theoretically pro-sex, but I've never really enjoyed it. I have all sorts of ugly issues involved. I know we all do. And I don't know if this will make them better or worse. I'm trying to approach the whole situation in a meta way, as an exploration of my feminist ideology. But every time I think about him touching me, I want to cry. And yet I'm very poor and soon to be unemployed. How much can or should I take my desperation into account? I think I'm going to go through with this, so I don't know what my question really is. I guess I just want to know how people negotiate all this shit and how I'm supposed to be okay. Thank you. LTL. Dear LTL, I said yes to this gig immediately. Within the hour, I realized I'd made a mistake. I was way too busy to be Sugar. The job pays nothing. I earn my living as a writer. Mr. Sugar also earns his living as an artist. There is not a steady job, trust fund, savings account, retirement plan, parent willing to pay any portion of our preschool bill, free babysitter, not maxed out credit card, employer paid health insurance policy, paid sick day, or even a middle class childhood between us. Between us, there are only two beautiful children and 10 mountains of debt. I can't work for free. I can't work for free. Of course I can't work for free. That was the mantra screaming through my head after I agreed to be Sugar. So an hour after saying yes, I composed an email saying I'd changed my mind. The unsent email sat on my computer screen while I paced my living room, thinking about all the reasons that it was perfectly unreasonable for me to write an advice column for no pay. Every reason was punctuated by a silent exclamation point. I had other writing to do, writing for which I was being paid, writing that would need to be pushed aside on a weekly basis so I could crank out a column. And what was a column anyway? I didn't write columns. I didn't know anything about giving advice. Plus, there were my kids. I was stretched thin already, my every not writing moment consumed by caring for them. The whole Sugar idea was ridiculous from the start. And yet I could not bring myself to send that email. I wanted to be Sugar. I was intrigued, sparked. Something powerful overrode all the silent exclamation points in my head, my gut. I decided to trust it. I gave Sugar a shot. I thought of this when I read your letter, Sweet Pea. It made me think about what's at stake when we ponder a gig, about what work means, about the fine balance of money and reason and instinct and the ideas we have about ourselves when we imagine we can be meta about our bodies and lives and the ways we spend our days, about what's at work when we attempt to talk ourselves into things we don't want to do and out of things we do, when we think a payoff comes from being paid and a price exacted from doing things for free, about what morality is and who gets to say, what relation it has to making money and what relation it has to desperation. Your letter unsettles me, There is the husband predictably casting his decision to deceive his wife as a benevolent one. There is your naivete about the logistics of prostitution, which is the correct term for the act of providing sex for money, even if you refer to it as a rendezvous. But most of all, there is you, dear fathomless bird of truth, telling me exactly what you know you must do, and then turning away from it. You don't need me to tell you whether you should accept this offer. You need me only to show you to yourself. I am theoretically pro-sex, but I've never really enjoyed it, you write. Every time I think about him touching me, I want to cry, you say. Do you hear that? It's your body talking to you. Do what it tells you to do. Be its employee. It doesn't matter what your head is working out, the monthly grand, the uncertainty of unemployment, the meta-feminist gymnastics. Putting faith in that stuff might pay the rent, but it's never going to build your house. We are here to build the house. It's our work, our job, the most important gig of all, to make a place that belongs to us, a structure composed of our own moral code. Not the code that only echoes imposed cultural values, but the one that tells us on a visceral level what to do. You know what's right for you and what's wrong for you. And that knowing has nothing to do with money or feminism or monogamy or whatever other things you say to yourself when the silent exclamation points are going off in your head. Is it okay to be a participant in deceit and infidelity? Is it okay to exchange sex for cash? These are worthy questions. They matter. But the answers to them don't tell us how to rightfully live our lives. The body does. There might be women out there who can fuck men for money and be perfectly fine, but you are not one of them. You told me so yourself. You're simply not cut out for the job. When it comes to sex, you say that you have all sorts of ugly issues and that you know we all do. But you're wrong. We all don't. You do. I once did. Not everyone does. By generalizing your problems regarding sex and sexuality, you're running from yourself. You're covering your wounds with a classic, "It's okay if I'm fucked up because everyone is fucked up," canard. It's a lie you've told yourself that has flattened down whatever hurts. But what hurts remains. Something inside of you that has to do with sex and men needs to be healed. And until you heal it, you're going to have to open and patch and cover and deny that wound over and over again. This job offer is an opportunity, but not the sort you think it is. It's an invitation to do the real work, the kind that doesn't pay a dime, but leaves you with a sturdy shelter by the end. So do it. Forget the man. Forget the money. It's your own sweet self with whom you must rendezvous. Yours, Sugar. The Empty Bowl. Dear Sugar, I could be worse. That's one of my father's favorite sayings. Whenever we heard a story about a man beating his children, murdering his family, locking them away, I could be worse. It was as if the mere existence of vileness and depravity could exculpate him of any wrongdoing. He never hit my mother or me. He didn't rape me or threaten me. These are the first things that come to mind when we think of child abuse. But while my mother would have left him if he'd lifted a hand against me, words, painful, horrible words, were allowed. Instead of bruises and scrapes, I suffered from internal pain. My father is a narcissist, controlling, vain, volatile, and charming. If I wasn't cheerful enough, he didn't want to look at me, and I was locked in my room for days. If I made a joke, he'd yell and curse at me for being insensitive. My room was my sanctuary, my books my closest friends. I could never be perfect enough, and yet I tried so hard to make him proud, to make him care. He was my dad, after all. I never had anyone to talk to about it. I couldn't fully trust my friends, and my mother was too busy pacifying my father to realize how much it hurt. My mother and I were the only ones allowed to see that side of him. Counseling was out of the question, and extended family visited seldom. He disowned me twice. They were over small things, slight disagreements that led him to denounce me as his child. When he decided that everything was fine again, I was expected to accept his change of heart, no apologies, unless they were mine. No further mention of the incident. Each time I let my mother convince me to give him another chance. But 3 months ago, he went too far. He betrayed my mother, and in trying to support her, I was subjected to an angry diatribe. I was a fucking bitch for finding out about his infidelity. I had no right to invade his privacy. This time, I disowned him. I moved out. At 20, I'd been staying at home for the summer. I've ceased all contact. And though my mother is more understanding of my position than she once was, she's still trying to fix that broken relationship. While I know I could live happily without my father, and that I'm stronger than I've ever been since he's been gone from my life, it's like I can never fully escape him. My mother constantly talks about him, how he's changed. She wants to know when I'll be ready to be around him again. It's hard to explain that I really don't feel anything anymore. In spite of my mother's claims, my father is still trying to control me, still so consumed by his image that he disregards my feelings. He found out that my therapist, an understanding, kind, and sympathetic counselor, was a woman he worked with, and insisted I stop seeing her. Yet another attempt to keep me isolated, away from any outside support. Still, my mother is pressuring me, sometimes unconsciously, to make it work. But I no longer trust him, no longer trust my judgment when it comes to my father. We will never have a good relationship. But is it right for me to sever it completely, sugar? So many people insist that family is too important, that it is my duty to forgive the man that gave me life. He's the only father that I have. But is it worth the pain, the self-doubt, and the depression? Could be worse. Dear Could Be Worse, no, maintaining a relationship with your abusive father is not worth the pain, the self-doubt, and the depression. In cutting off ties with him, you've done the right thing. It's true that he is the only father you will ever have, but that does not give him the right to abuse you. The standard you should apply in deciding whether or not to have an active relationship with him is the same one you should apply to all the relationships in your life. You will not be mistreated or disrespected or manipulated. Your father does not currently meet that standard. I'm sorry your dad is an abusive narcissist. I'm sorry your mother has opted to placate his madness at your expense. Those are two very hard things. Harder still would be a life spent allowing yourself to be abused. I know that liberating yourself from your father's tyranny isn't easy or uncomplicated, but it's the right way. And it's also the only way that might, just might, someday lead to a healthy relationship between the two of you. By insisting that your father treat you with respect, you are fulfilling your greatest duty, not only as a daughter, but as a human. That you stopped interacting with an abuser as powerful as your father is a testament to your courage and strength. You have my respect. I haven't had parents as an adult. I've lived so long without them, and yet I carry them with me every day. They are like two empty bowls I've had to repeatedly fill on my own. I suppose your father will have the same effect on you. In some ways, you're right. You probably won't ever fully escape your dad. He will be the empty bowl that you'll have to fill again and again. What will you put inside? Our parents are the primal source. We make our own lives, but our origin stories are theirs. They go back with us to the beginning of time. There is absolutely no way around them. By cutting off ties with your father, you incited a revolution in your life. How now are you going to live? I said you were strong and brave to stop communicating with your father because you did something many people can never do. You set a boundary. You decided that you will not be mistreated, and you acted upon that decision. That choice was born of anger and hurt. The territory beyond it is born of healing and transformation and peace. At least it is if you'd like to have a smashingly beautiful life. What I mean to say is that you've left your father, but your relationship with him isn't over. It will take you years to fully come to terms with him, and also with your mother, by the way. There is so much work to do that has to do with forgiveness and anger, with acceptance and letting go, with sorrow, and even perhaps a complicated joy. Those things do not move in a direct trajectory. They weave in and out of each other, and wind back to smack you in the ass. They will punch you in the face and make you cry and laugh. You say you will never have a good relationship with your dad, but you don't know. You will change. Maybe he will too. Some facts of your childhood will remain immutable, but others won't. You may never make sense of your father's cruelty, but with work and with mindfulness, with understanding and heart, you will make sense of him. I hope you have the guts to do it. After my mother died when I was 22, I wrote a letter to my dad. I hated him by then, but there was a bright crack in my hate that had been made entirely by my mother's love, into which my father could have slipped if he'd changed. In the letter, I told him my mother had suddenly died, and also that I had always hoped that someday we could have a relationship. I said that in order for me to do that, he first had to explain to me why he'd done the things he'd done when we'd been together. Sometimes I imagine my father opening that letter. It was 20 years ago, and though just about everything in my life has changed in those 20 years, my imagining of my father receiving the letter with news of my mother's death has not. In my mind, he cries softly at the news. He realizes his 3 children are now orphans, and here's his chance to make things right. Here's his chance to be our dad. It's not too late. We need him now. But he didn't realize that. Instead, he got drunk and called to say that I was a lying bitch, and that our mother had tainted our minds and turned my siblings and me against him. I hung up without saying goodbye. 17 years passed. Then one day the phone rang, and there it was, my father's name on the tiny screen of my telephone. "He's dead," was my first thought. I believed his 3rd wife was calling to tell me that. I didn't pick up the phone. I only watched it ring. I listened to the message a few minutes later. It wasn't my father's 3rd wife. It was my father. "This is your father," he said, followed by his first and last name in case I didn't know who my father was. He told me his phone number and asked me to call him. It took me a week to do it. I was done with him. I had filled up the empty bowl of him over and over again. I had walked barefoot across a bunch of crap carrying it in my hands. I hadn't let anything slosh out. I didn't love him anymore. I only remembered that I had loved him so long ago. I dialed his number. "Hello," he said, his voice so familiar after all this time. "This is your daughter," I said, followed by my first and last name in case he didn't know who his daughter was. "Do you watch Rachel Ray?" he asked. "Rachel Ray?" I whispered, barely able to speak, my heart racing. "Rachel Ray, you know, the cookbook writer? She has a talk show." "Oh, yeah," I said. And on it went, the most flabbergasting conversation I've ever had. My father spoke to me as if we spoke every week. As if nothing that had happened, as if my whole childhood did not exist. We chatted about low-fat recipes and poodles, cataracts and the importance of sunscreen. I got off the phone 15 minutes later, utterly bewildered. He wasn't delusional or ill or giving in to age-induced dementia. He was my father, the man he'd always been, and he was talking to me as if I was his daughter, as if he had a right. But he didn't. Shortly afterwards, he sent me a chatty note over email. When I replied, I said what I'd said in the letter I'd written to him years before, that I would consider having a relationship with him only after we spoke honestly about our shared past. He replied, inquiring what it was I wanted to know. I had come so far by then. I had accepted the facts of my life. I was happy. I had 2 children and a partner I loved. I wasn't angry with my father anymore. I didn't want to hurt him. But I couldn't pretend to have a relationship with him if he refused to acknowledge our life. I was prepared to listen. I wanted his insight, to know what he thought, and also to see if by some wondrous turn of events, he'd become a different man, one who could at last be my dad. I wrote the most generous, loving, true, fearless, painful, mature, and forgiving letter I could muster. Then I pasted it into an email and pressed send. My father's reply came so quickly it seemed impossible that he'd read the whole thing. In enraged words, he wrote that I should never contact him again, and that he was glad to be finally rid of me. I didn't cry. I laced on my running shoes and went out my front door and walked through my neighborhood to a park and up a big hill. I didn't stop walking until I got all the way to the top, and then I sat down on a bench that looked over the city. It was the week before my 39th birthday. I always think of my parents on my birthday, don't you? And I imagine it in the same way I imagine my father getting the letter I wrote to him after my mother died. It doesn't change, no matter what happened afterwards. I can conjure my mother and my father so clearly on the day I was born. How truly they must have loved me. How they must have held me in their arms and thought I was a miracle. They must have believed they could be better people than they'd been before. They would be. They knew they would. They had to be. Because now there was me. So it felt particularly acute to sit on that bench absorbing what had just transpired. I had that feeling you get, there is no word for this feeling, when you are simultaneously happy and sad and angry and grateful and accepting and appalled and every other possible emotion, all smashed together and amplified. Why is there no word for this feeling? Perhaps because the word is healing, and we don't want to believe that. We want to believe healing is pure and more perfect, like a baby on its birthday. Like we're holding it in our hands. Like we'll be better people than we've been before. Like we have to be. It is on that feeling that I have survived. And it will be your salvation too, my dear. When you reach the place that you recognize entirely, that you will thrive not in spite of your losses and sorrows, but because of them. That you would not have chosen the things that happened in your life, but you are grateful for them. That you have the two empty bowls eternally in your hands, but you also have the capacity to fill them. That's what I did the week before I turned 39. I filled the empty bowl of my father one last time. I sat for so long on that bench looking at the sky and the land and the trees and the buildings and the streets, thinking, my father, my father. He is finally, finally, finally rid of me. Yours, Sugar. Transcend. Dear Sugar, I'm torn. I feel like I have to decide between the two things I love the most. My wife and I have an 18-month-old daughter. Our marriage has been rocky for years. My wife is a heroin addict who relapsed post-baby after 7 years of recovery. She had been breastfeeding and snorting opioids until the night I caught her. I come from 3 generations of addiction from both my parents. I got sober myself when I was a teen and turned my life around while living at a boys' home, which I consider partially my home. I now work as a drug counselor at this very place. I have become a walking example for the Los Angeles street kids I work with, who are much like me. This work is my calling. It has even inspired me to write my novel, which has become the most stolen book at the boys' home where I work. Here is where the tear in my soul begins. My wife is from a small city in the South. I met her there. My mother died when I was living there. My wife was there for me. That city healed me. Recently, my wife got an opportunity for a job that's based in that city. All of my wife's family and support are there. She just had her second interview and is probably going to be offered this great job. I'm confused about what to do. Things are progressing for me professionally. I'm halfway through my master's degree in social work, and momentum is building in my life. Right before my wife got this job opportunity, she had confessed to being on methadone prescribed by her doctor for the last 3 months to wean her off her heavy addiction. She chose not to tell me, even though I have been supportive, and had been asking for connection since her relapse. It might not make sense, but I felt more betrayed by this than I do by her relapse. I just want her to have a connection with me. If she gets the job, I don't know if I can make the commitment to go with her because of my lack of trust in her and the positive direction of my life here in Los Angeles. I want my wife to be happy and near her family. I don't have family to offer her as support. but I cannot even bear the thought of being away from my daughter. I don't want to be like my father. I'm torn and distraught. Should I be with my daughter and my wife, or continue the path of my calling with the boys' home among the LA street kids I love? Please help me think this through, Sugar. Signed, Torn and Distraught. Dear Torn and Distraught, I teach memoir writing occasionally. I always ask my students to answer two questions about the work they and their peers have written. What happened in this story? And what is this story about? It's a useful way to see what's there. A lot of times, it isn't much. Or rather, it's a bunch of what happened that ends up being about nothing at all. You get no points for the living, I tell my students. It isn't enough to have had an interesting or hilarious or tragic life. Art isn't anecdote. It's the consciousness we bring to bear on our lives. For what happened in the story to transcend the limits of the personal, it must be driven by the engine of what the story means. This is also true in life. Or at least it's true when one wishes to live an ever-evolving life, such as you and I do, Sweet Pea. What this requires of us is that we don't get tangled up in the living, even when we in fact feel woefully tangled up. It demands that we focus not only on what's happening in our stories, but also what our stories are about. There's a sentence in your letter that matters more than all the other sentences. I don't want to be like my father. It's strange that it matters, since I don't know precisely what you mean by it. Nowhere in your letter do you tell me what your father is like. And yet, of course, I understand. I don't want to be like my father is a story I know. It's code for a father who failed. It's what your story is about. If you do not want to be like your father, do not be like him. There is your meaning, dear man. There is your purpose on this earth. Your daughter is the most important person in your life, and you are one of the two most important people in hers. That's more than a fact. It's a truth. And like all truths, it has its own integrity. It's shiningly clear and resolute. If you are to succeed in fulfilling your meaning, everything that happens in your life must flow from this truth. So let's talk about everything that's happening. Your first obligation as a parent is to protect your child. Allowing your daughter to move across the country without you, when you know that her mother is a drug addict who is struggling mightily with her recovery, is a bad idea, no matter how many grandmothers and uncles and cousins live across town. Until your wife is clean and strong in her recovery, she should not be the primary caregiver of your child. I don't question the profound love your wife no doubt has for your daughter. But I know addicts, and you know addicts, and we both know that no matter how wonderful and loving your wife may be, when she's in her addiction, she's not in her right mind. For that, your daughter will suffer and has suffered. It is your duty to shield her from this to the greatest extent possible. The struggle your wife is engaged in right now is essential and monumental. Everything is at stake for her. Her ability to get and stay clean is directly connected to her ability to mother your child and remain your partner. Her addiction can't be cured by a job or a new town, though those things may ultimately play a role in her recovery. It can only be cured by her desire to stay clean and explore the underlying issues that compelled her to become an addict. I strongly encourage the two of you to step back from the frazzled excitement of a possible job opportunity in a far-off and beloved town and focus instead on the monster that's hunkered down in your living room. What support and resources does your wife need? What role can and will you play in her recovery? Is your marriage salvageable? If it is, how will you as a couple reestablish trust and connection? In what city would you like to build your life together, and what does that decision mean for each of you, professionally and personally? If your marriage isn't salvageable, how might you lovingly proceed in the direction of divorce? How will you negotiate custody of your daughter? Those are the questions you need to be asking right now, not whether your wife and daughter should move across the country without you in the midst of this already tumultuous time. There are other jobs for your wife. There are other jobs for you. Much as you love yours, there are boys all over the country who would benefit from your leadership and wisdom. There are other times one or both of you may decide to move back to her hometown or stay in LA? Choosing not to ask these questions right now doesn't mean that you won't ask them later. It's only putting a pause button on what's happening in your story so you can figure out what it means instead. It's opting to transcend, to rise above, or go beyond the limits of, rather than living inside the same old tale. I know you know what it means to transcend. You did it in your own life when you made a whole man out of the fractured boy you once were. But the thing about rising is we have to continue upward. The thing about going beyond is we have to keep going. You have only begun to understand what it means to not be like your father. Keep understanding. Do not fail yourself on this front. No matter what happens when it comes to your marriage or your work life or your geographical location, there is no being torn when it comes to your daughter unless you choose to rip the fabric yourself. She wins every time. Yours, Sugar. A shimmering slice of your mysterious destiny. Dear Sugar, I'm getting married in a few months. Why do I feel totally aggressive and angry? How does anyone get through this event? Aggressive. Dear Aggressive, my guess is you're the bride and that you feel aggressive and angry because you're in wedding planning hell, and you're caught up in all the expectations, outdated fairy tales, overpriced products, and irrational beliefs that one adheres to when one believes it possible to flawlessly orchestrate the behaviors, conversations, drinking habits, and attire of a large group of in-laws, outlaws, friends, strangers, and co-workers, while simultaneously having a meaningful and intimate exchange with your sweetheart in front of an audience. It is not. Or at least it's not possible in exactly the way you're imagining now. I'm quite certain that whatever you're all worked up about these days, the colors of your napkins, the invitation that should or should not be sent to your mother's cousin Ray, matters little, and whatever will actually happen on that day when you get married will positively blow your mind. Your wedding is going to be a kick, honey bun, but only after you accept that it isn't something to get through. Perhaps it might help to stop thinking about it as the perfect event, but rather a messy, beautiful, and gloriously unexpected day in your sweet life. My own wedding was really something, though for a good stretch it appeared that everything had gone to hell. As our 100 or so guests arrived, it was pouring rain, and we'd made no rain contingency plans for our outdoor wedding. Mr. Sugar realized he'd forgotten his pants 60 miles away, back in the city where we lived, and I realized I'd forgotten the marriage license. My mother-in-law arrived dressed like a sheepherder from biblical times, if sheepherders from biblical times wore teal. And one of my old friends pulled me aside to grill me about why I hadn't chosen her to be a bridesmaid. I couldn't find the bobby pins I'd brought to pin my veil to my hair. And then once other bobby pins had been purchased in a mad dash relay effort that involved two local drugstores, I and seven of my girlfriends couldn't get the goddamn veil to stay on my head. Many of those things seemed calamitous at the time, but they are now among my most treasured memories of that day. If they hadn't happened, I'd have never run down the street in the rain, holding Mr. Sugar's hand, laughing and crying at the same time because I was going to have to marry him in a dingy library basement instead of on the banks of a beautiful river. I'd have never felt the way it feels when everyone you know volunteers to drive at an illegal speed to retrieve a pair of pants and a piece of paper. I'd have never known what a biblical times sheepherder might look like in teal and that important piece of information about my old friend. And I wouldn't have been so distracted by getting those goddamn bobby pins in my hair that I didn't realize the rain had stopped, and Mr. Sugar had discreetly enlisted our guests to carry 100 white wooden chairs a quarter mile from the terrible library basement back to the grassy spot on the banks of the beautiful river, where I had hoped to marry him in the sunlight, and did. We all get lost in the minutiae, but don't lose this day. Make a list of everything that needs to be seen to and decided and worried about between now and your wedding day, and then circle the things that matter the most to you and do them right. Delegate or decide on the other stuff and refuse to worry anymore. Let your wedding be a wonder. Let it be one hell of a good time. Let it be what you can't yet imagine and wouldn't orchestrate even if you could. Remember why it is you've gone to so much trouble that you've been driven to anger and aggression and an advice columnist. You're getting married. There's a day ahead that's a shimmering slice of your mysterious destiny. All you've got to do is show up. Yours, Sugar. The Ordinary Miraculous. Dear Sugar, the general mystery of becoming seems like a key idea in many of your columns, of how you don't know what something will turn out to be until you've lived it. It's made me want to know more. Will you give us a specific example of how something has played out over years of your life, Sugar? Thank you. Big Fan. Dear Big Fan, the summer I was 18, I was driving down a country road with my mother. This was in the rural county where I grew up, and all of the roads were country. The houses spread out over miles, hardly any of them in sight of a neighbor. Driving meant going past an endless stream of trees and fields and wildflowers. On this particular afternoon, my mother and I came upon a yard sale at a big house where a very old woman lived alone, her husband dead, her kids grown and gone. "Let's look and see what she has," my mother said as we passed. So I turned the car around and pulled into the old woman's driveway, and the two of us got out. We were the only people there. Even the old woman whose sale it was didn't come out of the house, only waving to us from a window. It was August, the last stretch of time that I would live with my mother. I'd completed my first year of college by then, and I'd returned home for the summer because I'd gotten a job in a nearby town. In a few weeks, I'd go back to college, and I'd never again live in the place I called home, though I didn't know that then. There was nothing much of interest at the yard sale, I saw, as I made my way among the junk, old cooking pots and worn-out board games, incomplete sets of dishes in faded, unfashionable colors, and appalling polyester pants. But as I turned away, just before I was about to suggest that we should go, something caught my eye. It was a red velvet dress, trimmed with white lace, fit for a toddler. "Look at this," I said, and held it up to my mother, who said, "Oh, isn't that the sweetest thing?" And I agreed, and then set the dress back down. In a month, I'd be 19. In a year, I'd be married. In 3 years, I'd be standing in a meadow not far from that old woman's yard, holding the ashes of my mother's body in my palms. I was pretty certain at that moment that I would never be a mother myself. Children were cute, but ultimately annoying, I thought then. I wanted more out of life. And yet, ridiculously, inexplicably, on that day the month before I turned 19, as my mother and I poked among the detritus of someone else's life, I kept returning to that red velvet dress fit for a toddler. I don't know why. I cannot explain it even now, except to say something about it called powerfully to me. I wanted that dress. I tried to talk myself out of wanting it as I smoothed my hands over the velvet. There was a small square of masking tape near its collar that said $1. "You want that dress?" my mother asked, glancing up nonchalantly from her own perusals. "Why would I?" I snapped, perturbed with myself more than her. "For someday," said my mother. "But I'm not even going to have kids," I argued. "You can put it in a box," she replied. "Then you'll have it, no matter what you do." "I don't have a dollar," I said with finality. "I do," my mother said, and reached for the dress. I put it in a box, in a cedar chest that belonged to my mother. I dragged it with me all the way along the scorching trail of my 20s and into my 30s. I had a son, and then a daughter. The red dress was a secret only known by me, buried for years among my mother's best things. When I finally unearthed it and held it again, it was like being slapped and kissed at the same time. Like the volume was being turned way up and also way down. The two things that were true about its existence had an opposite effect and were yet the same single fact. My mother bought a dress for the granddaughter she'll never know. My mother bought a dress for the granddaughter she'll never know. How beautiful. How ugly. How little. How big. How painful. How sweet. It's almost never until later that we can draw a line between this and that. There was no force at work other than my own desire that compelled me to want that dress. Its meaning was made only by my mother's death and my daughter's birth. And then it meant a lot. The red dress was the material evidence of my loss, but also of the way my mother's love had carried me forth beyond her, her life extending years into my own in ways I never could have imagined. It was a becoming that I would not have dreamed was mine the moment that red dress caught my eye. My daughter doesn't connect me to my mother more than my son does. My mother lives as brightly in my boy child as she does in my girl. But seeing my daughter in that red dress on the second Christmas of her life gave me something beyond words. The feeling I got was like that original double whammy I'd had when I first pulled that dress from the box of my mother's best things. Only now it was, my daughter is wearing a dress that her grandmother bought her at a yard sale. My daughter is wearing a dress that her grandmother bought her at a yard sale. It's so simple, it breaks my heart. How unspecial that fact is to so many. How ordinary for a child to wear a dress her grandmother bought her. But how very extraordinary it was to me. I suppose this is what I mean when I say we cannot possibly know what will manifest in our lives. We live and have experiences and leave people we love and get left by them. People we thought would be with us forever aren't, and people we didn't know would come into our lives do. Our work here is to keep faith with that, to put it in a box and wait, to trust that someday we will know what it means, so that when the ordinary miraculous is revealed to us, we will be there, standing before the baby girl in the pretty dress, grateful for the smallest things. Yours, Sugar. We call this a clusterfuck. Note, the following two letters are from each of the women involved in the situation detailed in the letters. Dear Sugar, I recently had sex with a guy who has a complicated history with a friend of mine. I knew sleeping with him would hurt my friend's feelings, and so I told her I wouldn't. She didn't ask me not to sleep with him, but it was implied. She would make references to his crush on me, and once asked him if we had had a threesome with this other girl. Long story short, I broke my promise. I meant what I said to my friend at the time, Sugar, but I failed. The man in question is a good guy. I enjoyed spending time with him, and let's just say my bed has been rather empty of late. My desire outweighed the potential hurt I knew my actions would cause. The guy and my friend have had many conversations since I slept with him, and they appear to have made up, whereas my friendship with her is still on shaky ground. I think it will normalize eventually, but I already feel like our friendship is something that's not that important to her. I don't even know if it's all that important to me either. Very recently, my stepdad had a heart attack. It was his second. It made me think about gravity and consequence and trivialities, and that if this one night of problematic sex forever alters or negates all the other ways I've been a good friend to her, then so be it. If that's the case, our friendship wasn't meant to last, and I have more important things to worry about. But at the same time, I can't help but wonder if I'm losing my humanity a little, because today an ex-friend of mine basically said she hadn't completely forgiven me for hurting her 6 years ago. I cheated on her like the dumb 22-year-old I was, and I've apologized 1,000 times since then. We weren't friends for a while, but we became good friends again, eventually. Until today, I was operating under the assumption that we were okay. To hear her say she relates to me differently, that she withholds information from me because of how I behaved years ago, makes me profoundly sad and angry. What does it mean if someone forgives you, but never forgets? I feel both horrible and stubborn, and I don't know how much of this anger is due to acknowledging potentially ugly truths about myself, that I value desire at the expense of my friendships, that I can't seem to learn from past mistakes, that I am a person others deem untrustworthy. The last one stings the worst, and is a doubt I expressed to the guy shortly after our tryst. She never trusted you, he said, which was a confirmation of my fears, if not a self-fulfilling prophecy. I would probably have done the same thing given another opportunity, and I don't know if that should worry me, or if it makes me some kind of pleasure addict, or just a terrible friend. I don't regret my recent behavior, but should I? Am I throwing away solid friendships for stupid sexual gratification? Part of me feels selfish even writing to you, because I know you'll call me honey bun and make me feel better when I don't deserve it. Friend or foe? Dear Sugar, I have two friends who I love dearly. One is a man I've known since we were teenagers. A few years ago, he and I started a brief non-monogamous romance. He then fell in love with another woman, who he rightly chose over me. Though I knew we were meant to be friends instead of romantic partners, my feelings for him ran deep, so I was crushed. Eventually, the pain subsided and we became closer as friends. The other friend is a woman I admire greatly as a writer and as a person. She's witty, sexy, brilliant. We support each other through romantic traumas and laugh constantly whenever we're together. She was there to comfort me when my male friend told me he had met someone else. She sat with me as I unabashedly cried in public in the middle of downtown San Francisco. Recently, these two friends met and hit it off. He started joking about sleeping with her. He's single now. I told my male friend that this idea made me feel uncomfortable, but he dismissed my worries. I didn't press the issue because my female friend swore that she would never sleep with him. She said this to me repeatedly, emphatically, even when I didn't ask her. While I was over my attraction to this guy, the history was still a little too fresh, and I wasn't finished processing the heartbreak. She saw how it was still affecting me. I trusted her. But it happened anyway. They slept together. When my male friend told me, I got very upset. I yelled at him for the way he'd dismissed my feelings in the past. We talked on several very long phone calls, and by the end of it, I felt heard, valued, and respected. He also forced me to come to terms with my jealousy and lack of claim I have over others' actions. Since then, I've had to do a lot of hard looking at my own insecurity and desire for control. 2 weeks later, when my female friend apologized for breaking the promise she had made to me, I told her I no longer thought I'd had a right to that promise in the first place, even though it hurt and angered me when she broke it. She had done what she felt was right for her, and now I had to figure out what was right for me, taking time and space. Part of me felt at peace with this conclusion, but by that point, I also felt so emotionally exhausted by the whole situation and so disgusted with myself, I wasn't even sure I deserved an apology from anyone. Sugar, I'm conflicted. I know what they did wasn't morally wrong. I've felt desire before for the exes of friends and the friends of exes. These two friends have a relationship that's independent of me. Still, I was so hurt. And the worst part is, I'm ashamed of my hurt. I'm ashamed of the jealousy I didn't know was still in me, even 18 months after the romance ended. I want to be the person who can gracefully take joy in the fact that two people I love were able to share some sexy fun. I want to believe that the hurt is all in my possessive, competitive little brain, so I can just change myself and get over it. All I do now is beat myself up for whatever choice I make. My internal compass on this matter is so broken. I need your wise, soothing words. Love, Triangled. Dear women, a couple of years ago, the baby Sugars got into a vicious fight over the decapitated head of a black-haired plastic princess. My son was all but frothing at the mouth. My daughter screamed so hard for so long, I thought the neighbors were going to call the cops. The decapitated head in question was about the size of a gumball. Its neck not a proper neck, but rather an opening into which a tiny, interchangeable torso was meant to be snapped. This torso was either the ancient female Egyptian my daughter was holding in her hand, or the sultry-skirted girl pirate my son was holding in his. Hence the uproar. Neither of them could be convinced to relinquish their claim on the decapitated head of the black-haired plastic princess, no matter how gently or sternly or maniacally I explained that they could take turns, each of them attaching the head to their torso for short periods of time. Likewise, they refused to be consoled by any one of the countless items that clutter the room they share. Not the bin of agates or the wooden daggers, Not the stuffed kittens or the alphabet flashcards. Not the foam swords or the half-trashed markers. Not the ballerinas or the Roman warriors or monkeys or fairy statuettes or fake golden coins or movie-inspired action figures or unicorns or race cars or dinosaurs or tiny spiral-bound notebooks or any other damn thing in the whole mother-loving universe but the decapitated head of the black-haired plastic princess. "It's mine!" my daughter shrieked. "I was playing with it first," countered my son. "It's special to me," wailed my daughter. "She plays with my special toys all the time," my son bellowed. I talked and reasoned and made suggestions that soon became commands. But really, ultimately, there was nothing to be done. There was one head and two torsos. The indisputable fact of that was like a storm we had to ride out until all the trees were blown down. I begin with this allegorical snippet from Shea Sugar, not because I think your individual and joint struggles regarding your friendship are as infantile as a tussle over a toy, but rather because I think it's instructive to contemplate in essential terms our desire to have not only what is ours, but what also belongs to those we love. And not only because we want those things for ourselves, but because we want the other person not to have them. That fervor is age-old and endless, and a gumball-sized piece at the core of what we're grappling with here, and I invite you both to ponder it. We all have a righteous claim to the decapitated head of the black-haired plastic princess. We believe she is ours alone to hold. We refuse to let her go. Before we begin disentangling your situation in earnest, I'll say right out that I'm quite sure if the two of you continue talking silently to yourselves about this icky and weird thing that happened with the man I'm going to go ahead and call the Foxy Fellow, you're going to regret it. And more than that, you're going to hatch a whole slew of increasingly distorted beliefs about what went down and what that means and who did and said what. And it will not only make you miserable and sad and bitter, it will also rob you of a friend who you really should be sitting on a porch with 10 years in the future, laughing about what knuckleheads you were back in the day. You both did something you basically know wasn't so great. Your desires and fears and failings and unreasonable expectations and things you won't admit to yourselves clicked into each other as neatly as a plastic head does into a plastic torso. And when you put them together, you both got pinched. The same thing happened to you from different points of view. With whom should our sympathies lie? On which woman's shoulders should the blame be placed? In what directions do the arrows of your narratives flow? How best do you find your way out of this place? These are the questions I asked myself as I considered your letters. Every time I tried to straighten the stories out in my head, they got all tangled up instead. I made charts and lists with bullet points. I took a piece of paper and drew a map. I turned your Foxy Fellow imbroglio into a pair of mathematical equations of the sort I never learned how to do properly in school, which utterly frees me to use them for my own whimsical literary purposes. Here's how they look. Friend or foe? I solemnly swear that I will never fuck the Foxy Fellow, because my friend still has tender and territorial feelings for him, and I don't want to hurt her. Plus, I'm a caring person, and fucking the Foxy Fellow would compel me to question the sort of person I believe myself to be. Plus, fuck the Foxy Fellow anyway, equals eek, ugh, squared, times. But perhaps when I really think about it, my friendship with this woman is not that important. Divided by, and yet, there was that time I sat with her in downtown San Francisco while she bawled unabashedly. Greater than, so, minus, fuck this shit. Plus, how dare she be mad at me? Plus, I was a good friend to her in every other way. Plus, the Foxy Fellow has not even been her boyfriend for, like, ever. Plus, I am attracted to him. Plus, he is attracted to me. Plus, I'm not even 30 and my vagina is growing cobwebs. Plus, who the hell is she to say who the Foxy Fellow and I get to have sex with in the first place? Less than, I am a terrible person and a selfish sex fiend. Will the damn ex-girlfriend please present her testimony to the court? divided by cheated, yes, plus lied, yes, plus to ever be trusted or forgiven, no, never. Not by any woman, in any time, for any reason whatsoever.